Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hope you had a fabulous Thanksgiving weekend. Thanks for tuning in today. With me now, journalist and biographer Walter Isaacson, who has run Time Magazine and CNN. He is CEO of the Aspen Institute. Among other things that he's done, he has written biographies of Albert Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, and Henry Kissinger, which one doesn't belong. He helped put news online for free at the beginning of the internet era, but now thinks news organizations should consider micropayments, kind of like those 99-cent dings that you hardly think about when buying from iTunes, and much more. His new book is a collection of his writings about people. It's called American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and the Heroes of a Hurricane, including pieces about Ronald Reagan and Franklin and Kissinger and Einstein, Hillary Clinton, Bill Gates, and more. So hi, Walter. Thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be back with you, Brian.
Let me pluck a line that you quote from Albert Einstein to start, that imagination is more important than knowledge. You think that's true in science and politics alike?
Absolutely. I mean, it's what I wrote about with Benjamin Franklin in politics, when he has the imagination to figure out how you're going to have a constitutional convention that'll satisfy the big states and the little states. And with Albert Einstein, he was just a third-class patent clerk in 1905 because he couldn't get an academic job. He couldn't get a teaching fellowship. You know, he was not really the best educated or most knowledgeable physicist by far in Europe. They were all wondering why the speed of light always seemed constant. It took the imagination of a patent clerk who was looking at patent applications for synchronizing clocks, how you send a radio or a light signal between two distant clocks to synchronize them, to figure out that the speed of light is always constant, but as you approach the speed of light, time slows down. That's an amazing imaginative leap, and that's why he said that his imagination was more important than his knowledge.
And you used that Einstein quote to knock McGeorge Bundy, one of the so-called best and brightest from the Kennedy administration. Why did it apply to him and to Kennedy overall?
I think you probably know, Brian, from your show that you've had a lot of really smart people on, really bright, and sometimes they don't amount to much. And sometimes they're actually problematic, let's say, as the best and the brightest were in the days of McGeorge Bundy, because they are arrogant. They think they know everything, and they don't listen. They're not wise. They don't have the creativity or the imagination. So, you know, nobody was smarter in the Kennedy administration than McGeorge Bundy, and yet he was the one who helped Kennedy and then Johnson march us into the quagmire of Vietnam. So it was that lack of full understanding, wisdom, perhaps even humility, that I think is important if you're not just going to be one of those really smart people who are a dime a dozen and ends up not amounting to much.
I cringe as I ask this question, Walter, but do you see any of the same tendencies in the Obama White House? Because here we are on the verge of another controversial Asian war escalation from arguably the most best and brightest oriented White House since JFK.
Yes, I do, and I'm cringe as well. I do not believe that occupying territory, which is the thesis that General McChrystal pushed, which is let's secure and hold and occupy territory in order to make the population safe. I do not believe that that's a good long-term or medium-term strategy. Nobody likes to be occupied. It's not in our genetic makeup. In the 1770s, we didn't even like it when the British were occupying the colonies. So if you look at the Israeli occupation of the West Bank or the British occupation of India, or if America starts trying to secure and hold large amounts of territory and take iris scans of all the tribal leaders and man checkpoints, I do not think that's a recipe for long-term success in Afghanistan.
Though the Obama administration would argue, I'm sure, that this would be very different from the Israelis occupying Palestinian territory or the British occupying India, because in those cases, the British or the Israelis are doing it for their purposes. In this case, Obama would probably say, we are doing this on behalf of the majority of the Afghanistan people against the Taliban thugs who would stop girls from going to school and everything else, at the same time as it's in U.S. national security interests.
all throughout our history, we've interwoven our ideals and our interests. In other words, we've done things for good moral purposes. And I think you're right. I think the Obama administration would be right to saying we're doing this partly for moral reasons. I'm sure, though, the British said that about India as well. I do not think that occupations and securing and holding territory, even when done for the best of moral reasons, end up working out well.
Is that why this tendency of the best and the brightest not to get things like that, that there is such a threat of anti-intellectualism in this country? Or do you think we'd have that even if, say, JFK got Vietnam right?
Well, first of all, I think the problem that leads to anti-intellectualism is the arrogance and the elitism that sometimes happens. That was the case with the best and the brightest in Vietnam. And I think if you're going barreling into another country thinking you're doing it for the best interests of the population there, you're usually 50% right and 50% arrogant. And it's the arrogance that people reject. Throughout American history, especially rising up with Andrew Jackson, there's always been a distrust about the relationship between big banks, the financiers, and the elite. And there's an odious smell of truth to that these days when you look at the bailouts and the bonuses, and people are rightly upset about those things. So you've always had this strand of populism running through the American character. I don't think it ever becomes, other than in the age of Jackson, strong enough to elect a president and change the course of the government. But that's what I think you see is happening right now, is a rise of angry populism again.
Walter Isaacson, my guest on WNYC. His new book is American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and the Heroes of a Hurricane. He's from New Orleans, and we'll talk about that in a little while. You weren't shy about giving your opinion there about Afghanistan, Walter, and yet one of my favorite lines from your book is why you say you were never cut out to be a pundit or a preacher. Do you remember your reason?
Yeah, well, I have a lot of opinions, and I wake up each morning not sure I believe in all of them or agree with all of them. And I will say that about Afghanistan. I will give the Obama administration huge credit. People say, well, they've been dithering, or Dick Cheney says they've been dithering. I think that this president has looked into every aspect of Afghanistan from every single angle, done it in a very conscientious way. He knows a lot more about Afghanistan than I do. I suspect he's not going to do a long-term secure and hold strategy. I suspect that most of the troops will be used to build up the Afghan forces, and for that matter, the local militias and regional tribal leaders fighting the Taliban. That's what I would do. I'm not somebody who feels you can totally abandon Afghanistan. I think you have to strengthen the anti-Taliban forces without putting too much of an emphasis on securing and holding populations. But to get back to your question, Ben Franklin said he always wrestled with humility, and sometimes he failed at it, but he was good at the pretense of humility. Well, I'll either try real humility or the pretense of it, which is I know I don't know as much about Afghanistan as, you know, General Jim Jones and Barack Obama and others now that they've studied it. So I'm keeping an open mind for this talk that he's going to give and explaining what he's doing in Afghanistan.
In your experience running news organizations like CNN and Time Magazine, do you think that lack of trust in your own opinions is a good quality for a journalist?
Yeah, I think that there are two types of journalists, and I think I mentioned that Walker Percy once told me that two types of people come out of Louisiana, preachers and storytellers. And I think they each have a role to play. You have certain people in journalism who are preachers and certain of us who are just storytellers. I think journalism has always needed, now more than ever, the type of person who's not there to push their own opinions, but to try to get the story right, to tell the narrative tale, to say, here's the different opinions that went into making these decisions or this narrative, and to try to be objective. I think the notion that you can't try to be objective is a dangerous one. You can try to be objective, and it takes people who are not there pushing their own opinions and own agenda.
Is anybody hiring those kinds of folks anymore?
No, because not many, because whether it's cable TV or the internet, the expressions of strong opinions tends to be a less expensive way to gather a hardcore audience. It used to be in the old days when you had, you know, the CBS Evening News, and you had to get a broad swatch of people, you know, a whole, you know, a third of the country tuning in, otherwise you were losing in the ratings. There would be a desire to appeal to people of all opinions. But now I think with the segmentation of media in the digital age, it's easier to appeal to a 10% passionate group on the left, the right, the middle, the populist, the whatever it may be. And that means that objective journalism isn't as valued as much. It's why if I may blow a little smoke at you, it's why I love shows like yours, why I love the Lehrer NewsHour, why I love quite a few shows that I think are still holding up the standard of let's having some dispassionate discourse.
But this kind of show aside, and thank you, journalism needs passion also, right? So the great investigative muckraking, let's say, also comes out of people who really do have strong opinions and life experiences that lead them into journalism, no?
Absolutely. And I think in my book I say my sort of open-mindedness and willingness to see all sides has a virtue to some extent in traditional journalism, but it also meant that I was not as good of an investigative reporter as, say, a Woodward or a Bernstein. When I was young and working at the Sunday Times of London and other places, I would get to know people, I'd be investigating them, and I'd start to see their side of the story as well, and I was not as passionate. I think that I probably would have been a better journalist if I were more passionate about having certain opinions, but I do think that there's also a role for editors and writers who are dispassionate and trying to just let the story tell themselves. It's nice to have that mix, and it's also nice to know what you're comfortable with, and for me, I never have won an investigative Pulitzer Prize, but I try to tell good stories and let the story of Ben Franklin or Einstein or even Kissinger tell itself.
You were Lou Dobbs' boss at CNN for a while, weren't you?
I did not. He did not have a show when I was at CNN. He did Market Watch at the close of the market. I think that that's a very good example of things I had to wrestle with and CNN wrestles with now, which is when Fox and then to some extent MSNBC puts on strong opinionated hosts pushing an agenda, and it's easier than sending people around the world covering stories, and you get a better audience. How do you do a show that's not opinionated? For CNN, the problem was that Lou Dobbs always wanted to do a very opinionated show. When I was running CNN, we didn't do it. We said no. He was kind of upset. But, you know, eventually he got his show. He did rather well with it, but it moved CNN away from its core mission and its core beliefs, and I think it was right for CNN and Lou Dobbs to part ways. Even if CNN's ratings are going to be lower, I'd rather have an Anderson Cooper or a Campbell Brown or people who are open-minded, not just trying to push their own opinions, as well as being able to turn into Bill O'Reilly or Keith Olbermann on nights when I want some stronger cup of tea.
Do you think there's a business model in what CNN is trying to do now since they are coming in third, both to MSNBC and to Fox?
I think there's a business model. I think that there is a good, solid audience that advertisers want to reach for serious news shows. It is not the world's greatest business model, but CNN actually makes money. It makes more money now than it did in the past. And so there's clearly a good business model, and one hopes there always will be a good, valuable audience for news that tries to be more objective rather than trying to be more opinionated.
Former CNN CEO and Time Magazine Managing Editor Walter Isaacson, my guest on WNYC. His new book is American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and the Heroes of a Hurricane. Excerpts of his biography of Albert Einstein and Benjamin Franklin and Henry Kissinger and writings about other Americans. And you tell the story, to stay on the media for a minute, of how you helped put free news on the Internet in 1994 when you were at Time. but you now support some sort of micropayments to help save journalism. Can you tell us some of the history first? Where were you in 1994?
In 1992 to 94, I was doing new media for Time magazine, and I was working with AOL and CompuServe and Prodigy. You and I are both old enough to remember Prodigy and CompuServe. And we were putting time, we created communities on those online services. We weren't just dumping the magazine on it. We were saying, here's stories and here's discussions around them and here's our writers online. And we had chat rooms and bulletin boards. And so you created a community. And we got paid for it. Every year we would sit down with AOL, CompuServe, and Prodigy and play them off against each other. And we would get $1 million, maybe $2 million at near the end of the run around 1994 for creating these communities on these online services, because they made money by charging people by the hour to be online. And so they wanted these good communities. Then the World Wide Web comes along and we all jump with both feet onto the web. I think there are two problems that the web is, you know, wonderful. I spend my entire day, you know, online.
And you said at that time you were involved in inventing the banner ad, which everybody loved to hate online, as the
yeah,
way
well,
to finance all
of it. Or blame totally, but Wired Magazine's folks and our folks, a guy named Bruce Judson, who was our advertising manager and what we then called Roadrunner and Pathfinder, worked together to standardize, you know, how you would serve up a banner ad so that you'd have your content and you'd have the server codes that would allow a banner ad to be put on top. So there were a group of people in our shop, led by our ad manager, Bruce Judson, and in Wired Magazine's shop, who said, okay, we'll standardize it this way so that advertising agencies can serve up ads on top of our content. And that became, once we put things on the web, a huge source of revenue because everybody thought, oh, this is the future. And so we'd just stand there on 6th Avenue. And people would come over from Madison Avenue with large satchels of, you know, cash money and dump them on our desk and say, we want to have ads on your service. We think this is the future. So it became a race to get as many eyeballs as you possibly could at your site. So instead of charging, as we used to do, or telling people you had to subscribe, we just opened it up and put everything we possibly could up for free. And we were supported by large amounts of advertising revenue, which was a wonderful model until the advertising market collapses. And also you have a long-range trend, which is you have an enormous amount of available space on the internet. I mean, available pages and services, but you have and that's growing exponentially. It's doubling every year, I'm sure, whereas the total amount of advertising is not increasing. Therefore, there's just not as many ads to fill up the spaces.
Right.
And what we were doing, we were getting $20 per CPM, you know, $20 per thousand views. Now it's like 10 cents
really?
Per thousand views because Google is just serving up ads to everybody's blog. And so there's so much supply of advertising space and the demand for advertising has decreased.
Whoever thought the real money on the web would not be in content but in just searching for the content?
Right, and that's another problem. And I'll tell you a third problem before we get to the payment model, is we were creating communities online when we were doing it in the early 90s. When the web came along, we went back to a model where we just took all of our reporting and dumped it online for people to surf by and read. And it wasn't a two-way dialogue. It wasn't quite as interactive. At most, you had a little comment section at the end of every story, and nobody read the comments anyway. So we went back to a model. Instead of media being a community-shared, user-generated system, it was back to the old model where we journalists, you know, from big corporations just placed our journalism out there for people to read. The good news is nowadays with social media, you're getting back to
communities
yes. online.
So what's the micropayment idea?
Well, I think micropayments are one of many things that would be useful to have in this new age. I don't think that's the solution to the problem, but when I wrote about it a year ago, I said you had to have different ways that people could be asked to pay for content. And if I were running, you know, Time Magazine or anything, I would say that part of our content should be free. The major breaking news, news is a commodity. And then I would also say that part of it, maybe after you've read four stories or eight stories online, you'd be asked to subscribe to Time in order to get the rest of it, because frankly, I think if we produce an entire magazine, somebody shouldn't just read it online for free and not, you know, read the whole thing.
Or pay, if you don't subscribe, pay as you go, 10 cents here, a nickel there, yeah, a quarter there to read certain articles?
Right, and that's a micropayment idea, which is sometimes you don't want to subscribe. I would subscribe to the New York Times and Time and the, you know, and Wall Street Journal, but I might not subscribe every day to, say, the Baton Rouge Morning Advocate because, you know, I'm don't usually want to read it. But once every 2 months, there's probably a, since I'm from New Orleans, I might want to read something from our state capital. I should be able to pay a quarter to get that day's issue of the magazine, and I should be able to do it very simply, just like you take your Easy Pass or your swipe card to go into the subway or down a, you know, through a toll booth. I should be able to have just a easy click in which it says the Advocate costs 25 cents. Do you want it? And I click yes.
Yeah.
And it somehow accrues to my account. And at the end of the month, I get a bill for those things I've bought for a quarter.
You know, Michael Moore was here recently talking about his film, Capitalism, A Love Story. And he made what might have sounded to the listeners like a socialist comparison, that in Europe, they're not having the same problems with newspapers going under because they're not as invested in capitalism, if you call advertising capitalism, to fund the newspapers. The relationship is more with the subscribers, that it's more based on people actually buying the newspapers than it is on selling ads. And yet, if that seems like a new idea, when I was reading your book, I saw that you quoted the legendary Time publisher Henry Luce many, many, many years ago, saying basically the same thing.
Well, I don't think it's just a socialist idea to say it's good to be beholden to your customers. And when Henry Luce said, we don't want to be beholden just to advertisers, we don't want to produce a magazine that we just produce in order to gain eyeballs that we can sell to advertisers, we want to be beholden to our subscriber, to our user, to our reader. And the only way to do that is to be able to get a revenue from your readers so that occasionally you can piss off advertisers if you want, rather than just cater to them. So I think there is a problem of saying all of our revenue will always come from advertising and nothing else. Then you just become a service vehicle catering to the advertising community, yeah, rather than being beholden to your reader.
Luce called it immoral. We're almost out of time with Walter Isaacson, former managing editor of Time Magazine, CEO of CNN, author now of American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. And Walter, in the introduction, when you first came on, I listed your biographies, Albert Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, and Henry Kissinger, and I asked which one doesn't belong. Have you been asked that before?
Yeah, I think maybe even you asked me once before.
I don't know.
I did Kissinger because I think he's a truly brilliant person. But I think that his foreign policy was detached from the moral ideals that are one of the underpinnings of our foreign policy. You talked about Afghanistan, and can we just be pure realists and say we'll abandon all the Afghanis to the Taliban and only care about our national interests? No. As a nation, we weave in idealism and realism, and I wanted to explore that where somebody, we talked early in the show about how they're very, very smart people in this world, but are they McGeorge Bundys? Are they Einsteins? Are they Ben Franklins? And so I was exploring what it takes to be not just smart, but be connected to the moral fiber of your time.
I knew you as a journalist before a biographer and was surprised that you turned to biography and history. Was it a retreat for you from news of the day?
It was partly the desire to write narrative, and to be totally honest, if you're a Time magazine as a young writer, you know, you get 2 pages in the magazine, 1 page in the magazine, and that's like 900 words, and you've written 2,000 words, and you get an editor who's cutting out all of your great, beautiful sentences, and you say, someday I want to write a book where I can just go long if I want to. Also, Time magazine and Henry Luce, who you mentioned, taught a basic tale that's there in the Bible for us to see, which is if you want to tell the story of our time, and if you want to convey the morals of our times, do it through people. Do it through Adam and Eve and everybody else. And so to me, if I wanted to explain American foreign policy, I was going to do it through Kissinger. If I wanted to explain the basic American values of civic tolerance, I was going to do it through Franklin. And if I was going to explain the magic of science, it was good to do it through Einstein. And it also gets back to that preachers and storytellers thing. When Volker Percy once told me that was the great divide, I knew, as I told you earlier in the show, I wasn't cut out to be a real preacher arguing passionately my own beliefs, but I did like telling the story of other people and how they were able to balance their principles with the need to be part of a community.
Is personality journalism sometimes the enemy of substantive reporting? Is there a temptation there?
I think we used to worry about that, but as Luce said when he was accused of inventing personality journalism, he said no. The Bible did that because that's the way we tell the stories of our time, is through people. Nowadays, Time, Newsweek, the magazines, they don't generally put people on the cover quite as much as when I was there. I'd go back to, I wouldn't be putting Paris Hilton on the cover, but I'd be putting all the interesting, inspiring people of our time, people who are great and creative and inventors and musicians, and I'd be putting Stanley McChrystal on the cover if I were dealing with Afghanistan. I'd say, I want to know how this guy thinks. I'd be, so I do think it's good to do it through how people's minds work.
And I was thinking all weekend about your sketch of Bill Gates as a child and how he used to be late for dinner by saying, but Mom, I'm busy, I'm thinking.
And then he'd say, have you ever tried that? And his mother then took him to a psychologist, and the psychologist finally told his mother, just don't compete, don't try. He's just going to be headstrong in that way. And I think people throughout the computer industry for the past 3 decades have both admired and understood that.
Walter Isaacson's new book, American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and the Heroes of a Hurricane. Great conversation. Thank you very much.
Very nice being with you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, New York's antiquated sewer system and why it matters to public health. And then David Siegel from the New York Times searches for a name for this first decade of the millennium.